Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
When we think of Newt Gingrich, I think we all think of somebody committed to renewing America, someone that brought a revolution to Washington, a political revolution, an academic revolution, actually aided by Texas academics, but primarily a revolution of ideas. Newt Gingrich exudes ideas, profound ideas. And these are ideas that he vets and he shapes and sands and organizes and applies in a way that resonates across the country. He is so dedicated to the idea of ideas that for several years he would invite a half dozen or so people for a week to stay on the coldest mountain in the country without any electricity. It didn't even have telephones, an environment only conducive to ideas. And over a period of 10 years, his strategy and ideas were developed that were then implemented in the first 100 days when he was elected Speaker of the House. Now, when you have all this success, I still imagine sometimes that Newt Gingrich, just kind of in privacy, is softly humming that popular 1920s song that words go something like this: why, when we're from a long line of steadfast heroes, are we now stuck with so many zeros? But he's far too courteous to tell us who the Democrats are, what the Democrats are, or what the Democrats intend to do to this country. But he knows, and he knows this well. But he also knows something about the Republicans. And when you read his delightful book, Pearl Harbor, you'll see in the acknowledgments he has written, our research shows that if the war in the Pacific could have been avoided if wiser heads prevailed, the connections between 1941 and today are clearly evident. So I ask, I plead, I beg that you can tell us, as the American people, what we are now facing. And I ask all of you to join me in the honor and the privilege to welcome the former Speaker of the House, professor, teacher, and great American, Newt Gingrich.
Well, parts of that were strange. I have never heard that 1920s song, although the night I finally won after two defeats and 5 years of campaigning, the song we played was actually FDR's theme song, Happy Days Are Here Again. I figured we might as well steal that as well as everything else we could from the Democrats. Just for a brief second, because I used to be a historian, and I want to set the record straight. We did not take people to a mountaintop that was desperate. We had a very dear friend, Bo Calloway, who at that time owned Crested Butte as a golf resort, as a skiing resort. And Calloway owned an area called North Pole Basin, which is the most heavily snowed area in the North American continent, in Colorado. and they had a series of houses that you could stay in. They were fairly stark, but they didn't have electricity, in part because it was so remote, and they didn't have telephones for the same reason. But they had gas lighting, and they had a gourmet chef, they had a trout stream. I mean, it was not exactly, you know, out there in a survival camp. But it is true that in 1989, when I became whip, we took 18 days and went to North Pole Basin, and we alternated planning teams. The people would come in for 3 days, and they would plan, and they'd leave, and we'd take 1 day off to go hiking, and then a new team would arrive and spend 3 days. And that the process of thinking through the fact that we'd been in a minority since 1954, taking everything we'd learned in the preceding decade when I'd been trying to figure out how to create a majority, that work probably was vital to our ability then to develop the contract with America and win control in 1994. And I've always owed Bo Calloway a great deal, but it was not quite this, you know, three hermits up on a mountaintop in the dark saying if we don't get a plan soon, we'll starve to death. This is obviously a very sophisticated group, so let me just give you a very brief couple of ideas and then go to questions. We are at a period of, I think, of challenge comparable to only two other periods since the founding of the country. The 1850s, when the total number of changes overwhelmed the political establishment, it could not find a solution and it stumbled into civil war. And the 1930s, when neither in Britain nor the United States could the political leadership explain reality, and people stumbled into the Second World War. In both cases, you had at one level a failure of leadership, because in an ideal society, one of the functions of leaders is it's sort of like driving a school bus or something. What you actually want in a school bus driver is a person who looks far enough ahead that they never have to brake quickly. And if you find somebody who's having to wear out the brakes because they're always so close to a wreck that they're having to put the brakes on, you know that's not a person you want as a school bus driver. Well, similarly, ideally, you'd like to have leaders who carry you through cycles of opportunity rather than stumble into problems. And in a very real sense, both in the 1930s and in the 1850s, we failed to find the kind of leadership that could do that. And in one case, we had the most difficult and painful war in American history. And in the other case, we had a world war. Churchill began his memoir of his five-volume memoir of the Second World War with a section in which he said Roosevelt asked him what they should call the Second World War. And he said that it was totally avoidable. It should never have happened. And he wrote a chapter on what he called the years that the locusts ate. And he said, we had every possible opportunity from 1935 to 1938 to stop Adolf Hitler, and we just couldn't bring ourselves to confront reality. And by the time that Hitler gave us no choice. Now, this was so clearly true that William Manchester, in his biography of Churchill, points out that as late as the spring of 1939, after Hitler has broken the Munich Agreement, after he has occupied Prague, after it's obvious that he's totally out of control, the establishment conservatives defeat a motion by Churchill to create a Ministry of Supply, which Churchill was arguing was needed because he said it is now virtually inevitable we will be at war before the end of the year, and we need a Ministry of Supply to be able to be effective in going to war. And they did not want to do it for two reasons. The first was they just could not bring themselves to confess that their policy had failed. And the second was that they hated Churchill so much that they knew that if they created the ministry, they'd have to put him in charge. And they'd rather not have the ministry than have him in charge. It's a fascinating period. Churchill only comes back on the day war is declared. He's brought back to the Admiralty. And to show you a difference in leadership, when he walked in as First Lord of the Admiralty, he walked over to a large couch behind which there was this covered map. He pulled open the covers, and it was a map of the world which showed where every German and British warship was as of the day Churchill stepped down in 1915. Because once he left, there was nobody there who understood why the map mattered. And so they hadn't updated it. That gives you some sense of the difference between leadership and non-leadership. We wrote Pearl Harbor to make the case that you should understand the culture of your opponent. You should be aware that you may be surprised, and you better have a strong enough national security and homeland security system to survive the surprise. And that you should recognize that technology matters, and that the side that has better technology has enormous advantages. I think the novel works pretty well. It takes you from 1931 to the actual attack on December 7th. We call it a novel of December 8th because that's the date in Tokyo. All Japanese Imperial Navy documents are dated based on Tokyo time, and the actual orders read, you will attack Pearl Harbor on the 8th of December. Because it's all dated after the international deadline. We deliberately try to build up both sides, and I won't go into detail unless you want to ask me about it, because every question I got at this table was about the current world. So let me talk briefly about the current world. I'm going to make three large assertions, tell you what we're doing about it, and then take questions. Assertion number one. This has been, for 75 years, a center-right country dominated by a left-wing elite. Starting with 1932 and the rise of the New Deal, you have had this consistent tension between a massive center-right majority and the news media, the academic world, the interest groups, the trial lawyers, the bureaucracies, and the patterns of the left. And the tension is palpable. Let me give you a couple of quick examples. Just to understand scale, 91% of the American people believe they have the right to say one nation under God as part of the Pledge of Allegiance. So that means that the middle of America, according to the Washington, the New York Times, is between 91 and 9. Um, 89% of the American people believe that you have the right to vote in a secret ballot election before you are coerced into joining a union. Yet the House this spring passed a bill that would strip the right to a secret ballot from workers in America. So just take a look at those two differences, because the unions can't win secret ballot elections anymore. So they've got to get to an open, sign the card or we can coerce you and ostracize you and browbeat you. 93% of the American people believe you ought to have the right to know about price and quality in health care before you make a decision. 93%. 85% of the American people believe English should be the official language of government. 78% of the American people believe that you should abolish the death tax because you should not be required to visit the undertaker and the IRS the same week. Now just take those numbers. I just gave you a set of numbers that run from 78% to 93%. Yet in Washington, they're a minority viewpoint. And again, in Austin, it's dubious because the state governments are all mirrors of the gradual rise of the left in this country. So our first point is to simply say one of the great, and this is what Reagan understood that nobody else has understood. Reagan was always an optimist because he always represented the American people. He had been an FDR Democrat. It's very important to understand. Reagan was never a Republican. He was an FDR Democrat. So he understood being in the majority. He got up every day happy because he was in the majority. I studied under Reagan starting in 1966-67. I watched him defeat Bobby Kennedy effortlessly on a TV debate in the spring of 1967. It was amazing. It was so one-sided. And it was on foreign policy. And from that point on, I studied him. In 74, I met with him and spent an hour studying how he gave speeches and what his technique was. And I studied under him when I was a member of Congress and worked under the administration. He had a very simple model. Find an 80% issue, stand next to it, and smile. Your opponent has two choices. They can stand next to you and smile, too, and say, me too. Or they can stand next to the 20% issue and frown. The average American looks up and goes, okay, happy, I agree with you. Frowning, I disagree with you. Got it, this election's over. Next topic. Reagan knew this. I mean, he knew it from FDR. He knew it from being a movie star. He understood the rhythm of communication with the vast majority of people. We studied under him. I went to San Francisco in 1984, and we had a truth squad, and we were meeting every morning to tell the newspapers and then the news media what Mondale and Ferraro were doing. And Mondale, some of you will remember this, Mondale gave his acceptance speech. And he said, the other guy is going to raise your taxes, but he won't tell you. But I promise you, if you elect me, I will raise your taxes. We closed down our operation. We did not want to get between Mondale and the American people. We believe deeply that in the Woodrow Wilson rule, never murder a man who's in the middle of committing suicide. So start with this notion that there is a potential, if you have clarity and calmness, to arouse an overwhelming majority of the American people, probably somewhere between 70 and 90%. And that changes everything. It means there's no red versus blue. I mean, it's red, white, and blue. You can't have red versus blue at 91-8 or 91-9. Because every precinct in America has a majority in favor of saying one nation under God. Every precinct in America, virtually every precinct in America, including most of the Latino precincts, have a majority in favor of English as the official language. Overwhelmingly, first-generation immigrants want their children to learn English. They're not stupid. I mean, the local college faculty may be stupid, but they're not. They know that if their child doesn't learn English, they are crippled for life. Very interesting difference. So that's box one. Box two is that we are at the edge of the most profound change in government since the rise of the progressive movement in the 1890s. The progressive movement from 1896 to 1914 essentially moved America into modernity. It took an agrarian 19th century pre-industrial model of government, and it modernized it to an urban, professional, corporate model. The Food and Drug Act, the city manager system, which came out of Galveston after the 1901 flood. I mean, all these kind of inventions were inventions of a deliberate effort, a bipartisan effort to say, you know, what would good government be based on the technology of 1900? Well, we're exactly at the same place. This is what nobody in Washington gets. I said to Russert one day, we're doing Meet the Press, and I said, Tim, you want to debate policy, and you want to say, let's go to Boston, and you want me to say, let's go to Los Angeles, and you want to have a debate over where we're going. I said, the car sitting out front has no motor. It doesn't matter what our policy debate is. We need to have a discussion about buying a motor. Well, that's where we are. This government doesn't work. It doesn't work at any level. The Detroit school system graduates 21% of entering freshmen on time. Cheats 4 to 5 kids, which is, by the way, disastrous at a human level, because if you're an African-American male who drops out of high school, you face a 73% unemployment rate and a 60% chance of going to jail. So every day that we fail to fix that, we have a problem. The border is open. The border is open because it's impossible for the current bureaucracy to close it. Second World War example. June 13, 1942, the Germans land 4 spies in Long Island. June 17, they land 4 spies at Punta Vedra near Jacksonville, Florida. By June 28, we had arrested all 8. Roosevelt insisted they be executed. He finally gave 2 of them. One got 30 years, the other got life in prison. Those were the soft sentences. The other 6 were executed before the end of summer. He was deliberately ferocious. The Germans did not try to land another spy for the entire war. They were stunned at how fast we were and how ruthless we were. That was the Second World War when we were a serious country. We fought the entire Second World War, the American part of it, from December 7th, 1941 to September 1945, less than 4 years. It's been 5.5 years since 9/11. In less than four years, we built a 2-ocean navy, built 50,000 airplanes a year, mobilized an 89-division army, sent divisions of Marines into the Pacific, liberated North Africa, Sicily, Italy, France, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, Holland, conquered Germany, swept across the Pacific, built the B-29, the most expensive project of the war, and the second most expensive project of the war, the atomic bomb, dropped the atomic bomb twice, and we're done. Less than 4 years. It took 22 years to add a runway in the Atlanta airport. Now, this is a core crisis of American civilization. Let me explain it to you this way. And I want you to measure this in your own life. Every one of you lives in two worlds simultaneously. There's a world that works, and there's a world that fails. The world that works has capital investment in information technology. It has markets. It has incentives. It rewards achievement. It punishes failure. It has the writing of Drucker and Deming and Juran, the Toyota production system, lean manufacturing, Six Sigma. And you experience it every day. It offers four things: more choices of higher quality at lower cost with greater convenience. Does it every day. Over here is the world that fails. We often call it bureaucracy. It is slow, pre-computer, inaccurate, has no sense of penalties, no market, and is unreliable. Now, I'll give you two quick examples. How many of you have ever gone online to check a package at UPS or FedEx? Just raise your hand. So I want to stop now. This is not a theory, right? I mean, if you go to see your House or Senate member to explain this to them, and they say, well, that's Gingrich has all these theories. It is a fact that we have built a system over here that follows several million packages a day in real time. Okay? Now we have the federal government. So this system, which ships a package from New York to Washington for $9.95 and allows you to track it at no extra charge, is living next to a system which cannot find between 10 and 20 million people who are here illegally. Let's look at the difference in the two systems, just in terms of pure effectiveness. So I've had a policy solution. We take a couple hundred million dollars. We send a package to every person who's here illegally. UPS and FedEx are going to find them, and then we'll know where they are because just click them. Bill Novelli, the head of AARP, has promised that the morning Bin Laden turns 55, AARP will find him. Now, let me give you a second example just to understand how real this is. How many of you have gotten money out of an automatic teller machine outside the U.S.? Well-traveled group. So again, it's not a theory, right? Calista and I were in Berlin about 2 weeks ago. Walk up to an anonymous machine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, put in a plastic card, punch in a four-number code. It reaches out 4,705 miles, finds my bank, verifies my account, validates I have money, transfers it into euros at a slightly bad exchange rate, but better than the hotel. Gives me the money, and it took 11 seconds. Is that about your experience? Now think about this. You have a system of sufficient accuracy that you are prepared to open your checkbook across international boundaries. Now, that's the world that works. Here's the world that doesn't work. A hotel in California is under an injunction from a state judge for trying to fire 13 people who have illegal documents on the grounds that in California judges don't think illegal documents are a firing offense. One of the 13 is the 42nd person to use the same Social Security number. Now, you know, over here you have a world where you actually expect it to be 100% accurate. You're the only person who gets money out of your account, and you can access your account no matter where you are in the world. Over here you have a government which not only did not notice number 2, number 3, number 4, they still haven't noticed number 42. But let's take a look at the difference in scale. And so I've said that the major problem I have with the immigration bill, other than that it's insane, is that there is no possibility the United States government can implement it. It's an absurdity. I mean, these senators are all sitting around in a room somewhere as though it'll work. And there's nothing outside the room. There's no possibility of getting this done. None. And it's not going to get done until you have a fundamental upheaval that fundamentally changes the system. Now, in order to deal with those two, we have a project called American Solutions. We're going to have a nationwide workshop on the Internet on September 27th, which is the anniversary of the contract with America. It will be available to anybody who's interested, a Democrat, Republican, Independent. And it is aimed not just at the presidency. It's aimed at there are 511,000 elected positions in the U.S. School board, county commission, city council, state legislature, 511,000. And if you're going to get real change, you've got to have a wave effect where across the whole system, people start asking new questions, having a new language, trying to learn a new way of getting things done, because you'll never get this system to work. So what you've got to do is migrate all these systems out of here over to the world that works, and that's going to be the job, I think, of a 10 or 12-year period. But it's absolutely essential to our being effective. Lastly, the third box is very simple and very daunting. We have an obligation to recognize that the world is dangerous, that there are people who want to destroy our civilization and kill us, and that we have an obligation to defend America and her allies and to defeat our enemies. I'm going to use a very specific phrase here, defeat. 1980, Ronald Reagan's running for office. Everybody knows that the Soviet Union exists. It's dangerous. You can't do anything about it. You have to have detente. And liberals were going to have a happy detente, and they would hug the Soviet Union. And conservatives were going to have angry detente, and they'd yell at the Soviet Union. But we all knew we had to work together. Ronald Reagan is asked by a reporter, what's your vision of the Cold War? He says, we win, they lose. Everybody in the elite knew this was crazy. 11 years later, the Soviet Union disappeared. Although it would be politically incorrect to point out that Reagan won. Now, I cite that to you because if you're dealing with North Korea, and you're dealing with Waziristan, and you're dealing with the Taliban, and you're dealing with Iran, and you're dealing with Saudi Arabia, and you're dealing with Iraq, and you're dealing with Syria, you had better have a strategy for fundamental change. Because if you don't have a strategy for fundamental change, you are going to get hit over and over for the next 30 years. This is a serious crisis. And you'll know how serious it is the morning they get nuclear or biological weapons, because you'll start losing cities. You'll know how serious it is the morning they decide to start blowing up your malls right here, or they decide to start setting off car bombs in Dallas. And nobody should kid themselves. We are not very far from this. The British 3 weeks ago sentenced 5 terrorists to life in prison without parole. We arrested 6 people in New Jersey just 2 weeks ago. And this is a real war. There's zero reason to believe right now we're winning it. Iraq is a tiny campaign in the larger war. Over 100,000 people were killed in Algeria in the 1990s. 300 people were killed in Algeria 3 weeks ago. 200 people were killed in India in a train last month. I mean, people just, because of the way we report things, people don't realize how real and how ongoing this conflict is. And it ain't going to go away. And we had better be prepared to design a real strategy, and we better be prepared to change our systems of government so that the State Department and the Defense Department and the intelligence community and the White House operate at the rhythm of the modern world, which is why getting from the world that fails to the world that succeeds is so important. I originally designed this after I spent all of December 2004 looking at Iraq and the global war on terror, and I just concluded the system wouldn't work. You cannot get it to work. It's too slow, too cumbersome, too bureaucratic, too lacking in accountability. This is a real crisis for the United States. And our ability to surmount it in the next 10 or 12 years, I think, may have a lot to do with what kind of future we have for our children and our grandchildren. So, a sweeping overview. Glad to take questions. Hope I covered some of what you wanted. So, fire away.
there in the back.
Yes, sir.
This is a fairly pessimistic statement. Would you comment on the following? The only way that the American people will realize how significant the post threat is when there is a catastrophic attack on a major American city.
Well, actually, I'm an optimist, much like Reagan. I think had the administration decided, okay, the question was, is the only way we'll get the American people to understand the threat to wait for an attack, like, in a sense, a Pearl Harbor on an American city. But imagine next time it's a North Korean nuclear weapon instead of two airplanes hitting the World Trade Center. First of all, in my planning, I assume that could happen. And I take very seriously the idea that my two grandchildren who live in Atlanta, who are 5 and 7, may be in graver danger than I was in the Cold War. So I take very seriously that that could happen. But I believe had the administration, after 9/11, built a real Homeland Security Department, and if they had had every year two exercises in cities for nuclear events and one exercise in a city for a biological event, people would very rapidly have realized how real this was. And if you look at the Israelis who abandoned a town in southern Israel last week under bombardment from missiles in Gaza, and you think about how would we react if Seattle was being bombarded, and then you start realizing this is going to be really hard. This is not going to be easy. But I think I actually do believe, like Reagan, that the American people have an ability to learn if they have leaders who talk to them in a direct way, and if they can convince them in a common sense way that it's real. I think the American people will do whatever it takes to protect their country if they think it's real and they think it's practical and they think their leadership is committed.
Mr. Speaker, last September you wrote a fascinating piece in the Wall Street Journal about the parallels that face President Bush and that face President Lincoln in the Civil War and the Iraq situation today. And one of the points that I think you made in the piece was that we, and you're echoing it today, is that as a country we still are not getting serious about the threat we face. And as I read your book and as I read your columns and I hear you on the news programs, the logic of your argument seems to be that we need to take Iran on militarily sooner rather than later. So would you comment on that and tell us what you think about what we really should do facing this nuclear threat?
Well, if I can break your comments into two parts. Part one was I wrote a piece last year in the Wall Street Journal comparing what Lincoln went through with where Bush is. And part two is that there's a logical implication that ultimately you've got to do something about Iran. And let me divide them. I spend more and more of my time studying Lincoln because I think in many ways the next 20 years will be more like Lincoln than like any other administration in American history. The most amazing thing about Lincoln is that he lost. I mean, all of 1862 was a disaster. Most of 1863 was a disaster. The 1864 campaign to Richmond was a disaster. I mean, they were getting people killed. More people were dying per day than have died in Iraq. And this is for a country of 50 million people. So his ability to somehow reach out to the American people and convince them that the cause of freedom was worth it. And I mean, he won the 1864 election for two reasons. Sherman captured Atlanta, which gave a morale boost in a sense that maybe they could win. And the Union Army, which are the people who are going to get killed, voted 80% for Lincoln in the absentee ballots. Because it, just like the people in Iraq who are re-enlisting, they actually thought what they were doing was right for the country. I mean, so first of all, there's a great book called The Eloquent President I recommend to all of you. If you want to see a master, maybe the master communicator ever to occupy the presidency and his ability with language. But remember, if you go to Washington, and I did a little book called Rediscovering God in America that's a walking tour of the Washington of the monuments. If you go to Washington, stand sometime and read out loud slowly the second inaugural, which in 703 words references God 14 times and quotes the Bible twice. This was a man in agony because he had presided over the death of 620,000 Americans, more than all of our other wars combined. So Lincoln is a very tough, but I think correct analogy. My position is very simple. I think our strategic goal should be to replace the governments of North Korea, Iran, and Syria, and if they don't change their financial behavior, Saudi Arabia, to do so in every single case by non-military means if possible. To study John O'Sullivan's book on the president, the prime minister, and the pope. Remember, Reagan in the 1980s unravels the communist empire, and except for the campaign in Afghanistan, it's all nonviolent. I mean, we don't liberate Poland by landing the 101st Airborne Division. We liberate Poland by having the Catholic Church, labor unions, the CIA, a huge amount of very clever things that were done, and being allied with the Polish people. And so if you look at the number of riots in Iran, you look at the poverty and desperation of the North Korean people, the fact that we have not been clever enough to unravel Kim Jong-il's vicious dictatorship, it is a shame on us, because I have zero doubt the average North Korean, once they understood the opportunity, would be dramatically in favor of us. And in the Korean case, the answer is simple. Pay every smuggler you can find. I mean, what you want to do is create an alternative system of getting goods and services in North Korea to unravel the dictatorship. In the case of Iran, you want to help everybody who isn't part of the dictatorship organize to replace them. I mean, there are ways to do this, and they don't have to involve military force. In the case of Iran, I would be willing at some point to have a covert operation to take out the only refinery that produces gasoline. There's only one refinery in the whole country that produces gasoline, and I would be prepared then to have the U.S. Navy slow down all of the gasoline tankers going in, which provides 40% of the gasoline, and just say to them, look, you want to play with us in Iraq? Fine. You're going to walk to the front. But this idea that we're somehow weak and helpless, as somebody said to me in Washington today, they can go up the escalation ladder faster than we can. Well, I mean, if you believe that, you've been defeated. This is the most powerful nation in the world, and a country whose entire gross domestic product is about the size of the supplemental. Literally, their GDP is about the size of the supplemental we're passing for Iraq. And they're going to intimidate us? That tells you about the psychology of Washington. It doesn't tell you about reality. Yes, sir.
Okay, let's hit the hard one. Between now and November of next year, what's the decision-making process?
We watch all these people. We decide which one we can stand adequately. You know, we hope that one doesn't blow it too badly, and we pray a lot. What process did you have in mind?
That's why we want you. What's the decision-making process?
Oh, for me?
Yes, sir.
That's very simple. We're going to do a nationwide workshop that's real. I'm not going to pay any attention to the presidential campaign prior to the 29th of September. We'll repeat it. We'll do it first on the 27th. We'll repeat it on the 29th. If it succeeds, if we have enough new ideas, if it's clear that we are in fact creating a frame of reference that is dramatically more powerful than you currently have available, I'll consider running. If there's space for a citizen candidate, but I'm not going to do any of the things that normal politicians do. I would not show up as one of the 23 people standing in line to be part of American Idol. Because I don't think that has anything to do with presidential leadership. I'd be glad to debate any of them one-on-one in either party. I mean, I'm happy to go out and John Kerry and I had a debate recently. Mario Cuomo and I had a debate. We did. Chris Dodd and I had a nice dialogue on Sunday. I mean, I'm happy to be on the same stage with people, so it's not fear. But First of all, I think it is destructive of the presidency to have 10 or 12 people standing in a row letting a television personality determine what's going on. Because you just gave up the power of the president to some guy who makes a living by, you know, being weird.
On Sunday, I watched your debate with Senator Dodd on Meet the Press, and you were outstanding. But could you repeat for the audience, when Tim Rutherford asked you, what would you do in Iraq, instead of talking in the generalities as the Democrats do, you ripped off about five or six specific things you would do. Could you repeat those to this audience?
I didn't come close. The question is, could I repeat the key things we would do? Let me say as part of the background so you understand this. I am the longest serving teacher in the senior military. And I've been teaching 1- and 2-star generals on the art of war for over 20 years. And I've known Dave Petraeus, for example, for years. And so I start from a very simple premise, that this is a real war. In a real war, there are a series of things you do. This is sort of the minimum. One, you triple the size of the Iraqi army. It's 137,000 people right now. It ought to be at least 400,000. You professionalize the Iraqi police force. You embed advisors so that we actually know what's going on. You fix the ministries so you actually pay people on time. You fix the American bureaucracy, which is why they need somebody in the White House every day who gets up and keeps track of what's working and what isn't. And there I just recommend to you what Giuliani did with Comstat in New York, which radically changed policing in New York. And I recommend the use of metrics. And you can see all this at newt.org. If you go to newt.org, you'll see all this stuff. I would say to the Iranians, we're not going to tolerate any more interference. And I would be prepared to start cutting off the gasoline supply tomorrow morning. And I would just say to them, you want to play tough? Let us explain how serious we are about this. They've killed at least 190 Americans with Iranian equipment so far in the last 6 months. But again, notice the difference. When the Iranians killed Americans at Khobar Towers, the Clinton administration deliberately covered it up because they did not want a crisis with the Iranians. Now, what do you think that taught the Iranians? And I would go in the opposite direction. I would do the same thing with the Syrians. I would say, if you want to see us undertake substantial steps to make sure that your minority dictatorship doesn't survive, then keep messing around. I would also dramatically improve our intelligence. When I checked a couple months ago, we were 8,300 slots short of the intelligence forces we're supposed to have in Iraq. I mean, we have not fought this war very well. We have not applied ourselves. We have not reshaped the bureaucracies. We have not learned from our mistakes. We have a lot of stuff to feel pretty bad about in terms of what we're doing. Yes, ma'am.
Can you comment on the immigration bill? Where do you think it's going?
Yeah. The question is coming on the immigration bill. Well, I think it's in trouble. And I think if you'll call your two senators and call your House members, it'll be in more trouble. And then if you email all your friends around the country and have them call their senators, I think when they go home over Memorial Day, I know two Republicans who were booed last Saturday at Republican events. And right now they're holding their breath saying, well, that was just a bad day. I don't believe it. I'll close with this, but I want you to understand why I think a fact-based dialogue is useful. As I understand the current draft, remembering that nobody fully understands it because they kept it secret as late as they could, 30,000 gang members would be amnestied into staying in the United States and couldn't be deported. Now, just take that as a minor insanity, okay? Apparently, the White House insisted they take out a provision on back taxes. So if you are an illegal, you would get your Z1 card. You would not have to pay back taxes. But if you had a legal work permit, or if you were an American citizen, to take two groups of people that they're not thinking about very much, then we expect you to pay your back taxes. Now, just take that one provision and say to yourself, have they lost their minds? Last example. We currently have a 4 million case backlog in the federal government processing. And they're going to say, and I have a very simple test for them. If they can tell me within 100,000 how many people there are in the U.S. illegally, I will consider looking at the bill. They couldn't get within 3 million. In 1986, I voted for Simpson-Mazzoli. Simpson-Mazzoli said, we're going to probably have 300,000 people get amnesty. The number was 3 million. They were that far off. Now, lastly, is there anyone in this room who believes the federal government can design a Z visa that cannot be forged rapidly in Los Angeles and made available to anybody who wants it for like $11.20? I mean, this is a joke. And I'll close this, but I want you to understand how real this is. In the 1930s, we couldn't get our act together. The British couldn't get their act together. They are behind the curve of the German army until August and September of 1942. They cannot get their act together. We can't get our act together. The Congress renewed the draft in September of 1941, 2 years into the World War. by one vote. In November of 1941, the U.S. House refused to fortify Guam because we didn't want to send a negative signal to Japan. The vote in the House occurred after the Japanese fleet had sailed for Pearl Harbor. So don't underestimate the capacity of democracies to be really short-sighted and silly. We have to have a fundamental overhaul of our system. We have to have the benchmark set by the private sector. And we have to have a federal government, a state government, and a local government, which is as productive, as accurate, and as capable as the private sector, or we cannot function in the 21st century. And that's the core challenge of the next generation. Thank you very, very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.